Hey there, I'm Marjorie Stiegler, and you're listening to the Career Prescription Podcast, where we tackle the important things they don't teach you in medical school, like how to treat your career like the business it really is, with strategies to accelerate the kind of success that you want. Because you deserve a career you love and a career that loves you back. Are you ready? Let's get into it. I am really thrilled to have guests on the program with me today from the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons, which is an organization that you may not be familiar with. I have Karen Schotten, the Associate Director at the NBPAS, and I have Dr. Karen Seibert, who is an anesthesiologist, also associated with the NBPAS. My podcast is about career development and often about non-traditional career paths. And a lot of times the questions that I get from people are about whether or not it is important to maintain their board certification, or at what point if you, you know, the more senior you get in even academics and clinical, but also in other leadership outside of clinical medicine, where you might take a role with a medical device company or with pharma or elsewhere, the more people move up and move out, the less actual clinical care they are doing. And so a lot of people come to a crossroads where they're wondering, should I maintain my board certification? And yet when you become a leader, that's often held in very high esteem. People want to have their physician leaders be board certified. So that's how this has come up for me. Maybe I could ask you, Dr. Seibert, to start with your association with that organization and to tell us a little bit about it.
Certainly. Well, first of all, it is an entirely physician-driven organization. The board of directors, of which I'm a member, is all physician and completely unpaid voluntary. We get nothing out of this except the satisfaction of knowing that we're working on behalf of a really good cause. So as opposed to the boards, which compensate all of their staff and their, you know, everything, to the tune of millions of dollars. We are a nonprofit organization. We are not trying to do anything other than offer people a path to demonstrating that they are continuing their medical education in a responsible, self-directed, and evidence-driven way at a very modest cost. I believe it's currently 72% less than standard maintenance of certification.
That's fantastic. Thank you for that. And Karen, anything that you'd like to add about your role with the organization or just to sort of orient us a little bit?
Sure. Well, I serve, as you mentioned, I serve as the associate director. And one of my, you know, primary roles is I always say I'm outward facing. So I'm looking out into the national landscape of healthcare, which is, as anyone who works in healthcare knows, is a really complex beast. We want the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons to be an option for any physician who's interested in certifying with us. And we have steadily been, as Dr. Seibert mentioned, been growing and making incredible progress, especially in the last 12 to 18 months through some really landmark marks of progress. And so my job is to sort of identify what obstacles might be in our way and work to make sure that those are removed so that it's a reasonable choice for any physician in the United States.
I think this is just so very interesting. I'll tell you and the audience a little bit about, you know, why I've asked you to come on the show. And then we can talk, you can satisfy maybe my curiosity, and then you can tell me what kinds of questions come to you. But as listeners of this podcast know, a lot of folks who are listening are really interested in their career advancement. And oftentimes that includes less direct clinical care, either moving up in academics or education, or sometimes moving into that more broad healthcare landscape in medical device or pharmaceutical industry or regulatory bodies like FDA. But board certification is still really seen as a requisite and an important part of a physician's credibility. And yet, when you're doing less care or you're less involved in an academic center, maintaining that becomes a little harder. It's less automatic. You can't just show up for grand rounds and have that sort of provided to you in that way. And also becomes, so it's expensive and time consuming. So people have asked me oftentimes, at what point do you decide to not bother to get recertified? You know, where in your career does it make sense to not worry anymore about either active licensure or board certification? And so because that question comes up, I mean, I obviously don't have a one-size-fits-all answer to that question, but because that one comes up, it occurred to me probably most people, myself included, until quite recently, also don't even know that there are that there's more than one way to maintain a certification, or that there's an alternative to their primary certifying body. So when they think about the required activities and the required costs and timelines of their original certification, I bet they have no idea that there's something that might be quite different. And so maybe you can spend a little time telling us in what ways, we both have already alluded to the cost, in what ways is it different?
I'd be happy to talk about that. The fact is, nobody can ever take your board certification away from you. Once you're board certified, you have passed a rigorous set of examinations and demonstrated sufficient clinical experience in your residency and a whole host of other requirements that we support 100%. We're not telling anybody that they shouldn't get board certified. In fact, we require board certification as a prerequisite for getting recertified through NBPASS, which is how we usually refer to the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons. So if somebody doesn't want to get board certified at all, we're not an option for that. I personally found the initial board certification process to be tremendously valuable. It really, you have to, the study and preparation that you go through really synthesizes everything you've done during residency. But after residency, everybody's paths diverge. And they may diverge in terms of the amount of clinical work that you do versus research or administration, all these different career paths you were alluding to. And this is one of the fundamental problems with the traditional MOC, as it's been developed by the American Board of Medical Specialties, is that they're really one size fits no one.
No, one size fits no one. Yeah.
It was originally they were all, you know, one 10-year exam make or break that usually cost over $2,000 to take. And that was just incredibly painful to people. I mean, you know, if they failed that one-time exam, they couldn't even work. There was no pressure on them to do anything about that. They had a monopoly. And it really wasn't until NBPASS came along in 2015 and there was an alternative that the boards actually started revising their processes, cutting their costs, making things more longitudinal as opposed to a one-time 10-year make or break. So just the element of competition that we've provided, I think, has made everyone's life easier, whether they even realize it or not. But the fact is, nobody really, they want to know if you're a good doctor. They want to know if you're current in your practice and your ability to answer, in the case of anesthesiology, X number of multiple choice questions every 3 months has never been shown to have the slightest bearing on any of those qualifications.
Yeah.
I think that the things that are so important to know about NBPASS is that we're now recognized by the Joint Commission. I'll ask Karen to give the technicalities of that, but we're recognized by the Joint Commission. We're recognized by NC, is it NCQA or?
It is, yep, you got it.
NCQA, and these other regulatory bodies as a perfectly acceptable alternative to traditional maintenance of certification. And I'll let Karen go through some of the details on that because her work and the staff's work in, you know, the incredibly lengthy process of getting this acceptance has been enormous.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear about that because I know, you know, the first impression that someone might have in hearing that there's an alternative to their primary board certifying body might be, oh, is this something that's less rigorous? Is it taken seriously? Is it meaningful to get certified in this way? So tell us about it.
Well, you know, I want to really double down on what Dr. Seibert said because she made some really critical points. And I think you have to almost take a little moment of a history lesson and step back for a moment and remember that there's a real difference between the initial board certification, which means you have expended incredible energy in a residency program, you've become a specialist, you've passed a very rigorous exam, and you are now, you know, unique in your among physicians in your specialty field. When MOC came out, they grandfathered or exempted up to 40% of U.S. physicians from these new maintenance of certification programs, as Dr. Seibert pointed out. And so to say that you're a lesser doctor by not participating in MOCs is really a little bit, we believe it's a pretty strong misrepresentation, because keep in mind, there are many, you know, wonderful physicians all the time practicing medicine, grandfathered or not. And the data is really clear. We're data-driven and evidence-driven. And to date, there's really no widely agreed upon double-blinded, placebo-controlled sort of study or level A evidence that we would say points to, you know, better quality doctors or better patient outcomes with MOC. Back to your original question, Marjorie, you said, well, many physicians ask you, what is that flipping point? When can I, when can I choose something different? And what I like to say about the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons in our certification practice, we never want to be seen, even though we're an alternative pathway, we certainly don't see it as a lesser pathway. And a huge percentage of our membership or our physician diplomates are actively practicing clinicians who see patients, you know, 80 hours a week, and they do not find the MOC programs to be of clinical value to their patient care, not to mention the administrative burden, time, and cost. So I don't think that we ever want to be seen as the organization for when you stop seeing patients. I don't think that's, and it's not accurate. So I think we have physicians who might fit into the category of some of your audience who are moving on to industry and perhaps seeing patients less. And we also have very, very hardworking physicians who are frontline every day who have simply had enough with that burden. So I think that's really an important to know. One of the hallmarks of our requirements is to require CME that is in your specialty. And we check that really, really carefully, because physicians know what they need to study. And even in something as broad as internal medicine, as a great example, there are so many subspecialties. Practices are really individualized. Your patient populations may be very, very different. And so physicians can choose the material that they need to study depending on the work and the patients that they see.
I think it goes both ways, whether you're in an incredibly limited subspecialty and you don't want to answer all these general questions, or whether you're in a really broad general practice. And how to position a double lumen tube, for example, is just not in something that you need to worry about anymore. Either way, the questions that are actually relevant to you are going to be relatively few out of this bucket of questions that you have to answer. I think that the really telling point was that the ABMS did a survey of over 34,000 physicians a couple of years ago. It's called their vision analysis. And the percentage of physicians that thought that MOC was worthwhile across all these different specialties was 12%.
Wow, that's a strikingly low number. Because
that is a strikingly low number.
People do like to learn, right? We go to meetings, we read, we engage in, it sort of sounds cliche, but in that lifelong learning. But people are not finding that traditional MOC to be a valuable way to do it, sounds like.
No, they're not at all. And it's costly. And again, the burden is undue on younger physicians, since a higher percentage of younger physicians are women who are also trying to start families. Undue burden on women, undue burden on people who are going into the primary care fields that are less remunerative. It's not fair. And I've never been a person who thought about fair. You know, fair is for sports maybe, but nonetheless, this is not a level playing field. This is an undue burden on young physicians who are already encumbered with debt, who are working very, very hard. And honestly, I think it's a significant contributor to burnout and to people leaving clinical medicine. I understand that people leave clinical medicine for a lot of very valid reasons, but I think we can all agree that to have people driven out of clinical medicine can't be a worthy goal.
Yeah, it's to me this almost the opposite end of that spectrum as you're talking about, you know, fairness of many people who feel that they cannot afford to take the preparatory classes and to go through the expensive process of applying to medical school. Like we lose people on the front end because they don't have the resources or the time or the support to pursue it, and then potentially losing people on the back end or in the middle there because it is so onerous and expensive.
I don't think there's any question that all these requirements can contribute to burnout. I have to say, you know, just the mandatory e-learnings that my hospital has required on all these different things, you know, it's like a drop here, a drop there, but all of a sudden it just turns into unbearable pressure and a loss of any free time. And it really contributes to misery. And that shouldn't be part of the practice of medicine.
I really appreciate what you said earlier, which is that even with just sort of the establishment of this second organization, you've seen that not only can you offer certification, ongoing certification at lower costs and with less onerous, though still rigorous and really relevant learning experience, like demonstration of competency there, that there's been a trickle-down effect. So that the traditional boards then, due to this competition, are making changes that are making their processes a little more palatable, I suppose, for physicians that continue to get certified in that route.
I think they've had to be responsive. But what I think a lot of physicians were worried about, this wouldn't be true for people outside of clinical medicine, but people were worried that they'd lose hospital credentials, that third-party payers would be reluctant to accept this. And that's what Karen and her staff have really been working toward, is making sure that the Joint Commission and the DNV and, you know, these other hospital regulatory bodies were familiar with NBPAS, that they recognize that this is a demonstration of continuing education that is physician driven, and, you know, that this is legit. And so now the problem of not getting credentialed, not getting paid, is really far less. The American Medical Association actually passed a resolution stating that MOC should not be a mandated requirement for licensure, credentialing, payment, network participation, or employment. And even the ABMS in that same Vision Commission report said, and you can look at the direct quote, but that ABMS must encourage hospitals, health systems, payers, and other healthcare organizations to not deny credentialing or privileging to a physician solely on the basis of certification. So even they acknowledge that there's nothing in their process that keeps somebody from being a good physician.
That's really important. I think that's something we all know, but it's really nice to see that. Or yeah. To hear that or read it.
I can't make that statement that you can't be a good physician without MOC. And they know that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They don't say it. But they would like for us all to believe it. And then, of course, as I know that Dr. Stigler is very well aware. So as you're coming up through academics, it just never occurs to you that there's any downside to the boards.
You know, that's fair. I have been a board examiner. So
they're like the Holy Grail. You know, that's what we all aspire to be, is a board examiner, or to write questions and things like that. And so there's absolutely no critical look at what we're actually doing. This is just part of the academic game. And so then everybody who comes on faculty just goes along with it, and nobody dares say the emperor has no clothes. Nobody dares go to an academic hospital, credentialing committee and say, oh, by the way, we should accept this. Although I think people are starting to do it now. So this has been more driven at the private practice level, where people were busy and they said, we don't have time for this. Let's do this to get people credentialed faster, get them on board. You know, let's just go along with this. and or support this, not just go along, but support this, is a totally legitimate way of demonstrating that you're continuing to keep up with continuing education of the kind that you need to do your work. Now, yeah. Karen can explain this in more detail, but for surgeons, we actually do, what are the requirements for a surgeon to be certified or continue?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of, again, we try to be evidence-driven, right? And keep everyone specialty specific, but we actually have something that goes above and beyond ABMS's MOC program. And what Dr. Seibert's referring to is if you have a surgical specialty, you need to have privileges in a what we call a deemed facility, what CMS calls a deemed facility, which could be outpatient or hospital. And we think this is really important because you could get 100 on every single test you ever take in your life and get every multiple choice question right, but you still might have bad technical skills in the OR. And so, you know, it's really important to remember that board certification was never intended as the everything credential, right? It's one part of the whole suite of what makes a physician a great physician. I mean, I really liked what Dr. Seibert said earlier. I mean, I don't go to my doctor and ask, how many multiple choice questions did you get right this month? That is not what I discuss with my physician. Yeah. I know a great physician when I meet them, right, in the exam room. And I think that to misrepresent what board certification is, again, very important distinction between initial and becoming a specialist through an ACGME accredited residency and this you know, this newer idea, which is just from the early 2000s about ongoing maintenance. And, you know, to the economics of it all, you both happen to be anesthesiologists. And so I quickly pulled some hard numbers from the American Board of Anesthesia's 990, which, if you're not familiar, is just the IRS mandated tax form for nonprofits. The most updated one that's available publicly is 2019. And they made about $9 million in change from initial board certification exams, which again, we feel strongly about positively and support, but their MOC revenue was over $6 million. So it's near, you know, it's changed their revenue model. And we also believe, you know, in terms of going all the way back to 2015 when MBPASS was founded, Dr. Seibert knows because she was there in the beginning, MBPASS really believes there's a conflict of interest here to charge for programs that are not really evidence-based and nearly double your revenue model. I think that raises a lot of questions. And to one of your earlier questions, Marjorie, about, you know, what are the practical nuts and bolts and what are the questions that we in the office get asked every day? I mean, the biggest question we get asked is, are you accepted? Can I do this? Is this cool? What happens next? And so, you know, yes. So amazingly, the Joint Commission named us a designated equivalent source agency to verify board certification. NCQA and their competitor URAC, which accredit health plans, also have us as an acceptable choice for board certification. DNV is essentially a competitor to Joint Commission. They are available. We meet all of those accreditation standards. And to the point of competition, there was a time when even the Joint Commission was the only game in town. It's a really good analogy for MBPASS because the FTC actually stepped in and said, this is not okay. It's not a one-horse town. Competition is good for hospitals. It's good for price. It's good for innovation. It's good for driving, you know, change. That's positive change. And so, you know, DNV emerged on the accreditation landscape in the hospital space, and it's made a lot of positive changes for everyone. So I think, you know, I like to say we're not here to overthrow. We're available as a choice. I like to say MBPASS is additive. If someone, a hospital or an employer wants to hopefully recognize MBPASS, it's a great option for their physicians. It's a great recruitment and retention tool for their physicians because it's so physician friendly. And it's a way to maintain, you know, clinical excellence throughout your career, whether you're seeing patients until, you know, for every moment of your career, or whether you move on to non-clinical roles. You're maintaining excellence in either pathway, but in a way that's much less burdensome.
I love it. I didn't know that there was an alternative to the Joint Commission. That might speak to the time, that might speak to where I've worked, or it might speak to the time where I have been out of clinical medicine now since 2017. So I don't know when that came on the scene, but it's a great analogy. And I can really see sort of the relevance here of you know, we of course want high quality. We want high quality in our institutions, high quality in our professionals, high quality in our processes, all across the board, but who is monitoring and, you know, giving that stamp of approval? It makes sense that that not be a single body sort of, you know, with a tight grip on what everyone should be doing, but with more transparency and more options, that really all of that high quality can be maintained in a way that makes sense for people in their careers or for large and small practices, or I'm just sort of guessing, but I know that certainly Joint Commission standards are easier to manage if you're a large enterprise than if you are a smaller office or an office-based setting and so forth. So I appreciate that analogy. It's a good one.
And, you know, this is kind of a, maybe a lighter point, and I hope you guys enjoy it, but I think sometimes not being a physician, it's a really interesting vantage point for me, you know, in the MBPass office, because I work with so many physicians. And one thing I've observed in general is that, you know, physicians are such high achievers. And so it's sort of a psychology or a mentality that you must be doing. If you're not doing X, Y, Z, something must be wrong. And so it's really hard to sort of, you know, as MBPass expands on the landscape of continuing certification, I think there's, you know, some people just sort of have that sort of psychological block that it's hard to do something new or different. And the example I'll give, I won't say when or where, but I was presenting to a live audience, and there was an older physician who was commenting, and he said, you know, I just took my exam and I just studied for 3 months and it was really hard and I did it and I passed it. And he said, and it was completely irrelevant to my entire practice of medicine, but I did it anyway. And he turned to me for kind of a response. And I said, you know, I didn't want to be disrespectful. And I said, well, with respect, I think you just endorsed MBPass. Because, you know, he was doing it because it was the way it had always been done, not because it made him a better doctor. And I think that's the key that, you know, and physicians, you know, I've had many friends who are physicians. I've had friends who say, we just don't stand up for ourselves enough. We just don't speak up for ourselves enough. And I think it's true as a non-physician perspective. I think doctors really do need to advocate for what's best for them. And if we can provide that choice and, you know, maintain clinical excellence in a less burdensome manner, that's what we exist to do.
I love that. And, you know, that also kind of brings me, it resonates with me again, when I think full circle, obviously not trying to focus entirely on non-clinical careers here, but as you've mentioned, you know, physicians often just behave in a way, this is what's expected of us. So this is what we're going to do. And it really limits a person's autonomy and freedom. And so many people, when they're considering being leaders in other areas in the healthcare landscape, where I'll editorialize here for a second, I think it's really important for physicians to be everywhere. Because if we are not in those pockets of all of the healthcare landscape, then we really are powerless to influence within those walls. And so I think it's really important. So I support that. Obviously, I'm a little biased because that's how my career direction has gone. But so many people that I know who are interested in contributing to healthcare in a different way are really fearful that if they walk out of the door of the clinic, even for a temporary period of time, just to learn and grow and do something new, that somehow they will lose their certification and their entire life's work of becoming a physician, being trained, being certified, and all of that will be sort of swept out from underneath them, and there'll be no way back, no way to maintain. And it's sort of paralyzing. It prevents people from taking breaks. It prevents people from pursuing other things professionally. And it prevents people from like growing and making the kind of contributions that they want to make and just feeling like they have any choices within their career. I mean, it's sort of fundamental. It makes people feel like they're kind of in jail. And so I was just really, really delighted to see that there is an organization that offers this kind of alternative that's just seems like it solves that whole problem, right? It helps to give physicians back that freedom to really take charge of and responsibility for maintaining the kind of knowledge and lifelong education that they need to do a good job at what they're doing.
Important point, though, because I've been asked this question before by people who wanted to take a leave or wanted to take an administrative job somewhere and were fearful that they might not have a bridge back. Maintenance of certification is one thing, and we can certainly offer that, proof of continuing certification. Credentialing is another issue. You know, I've encouraged people who wanted to make sure that they had a bridge back to maintain clinical credentials somewhere, which can be remarkably easy to do. You know, mm-hmm. It's really a handful of cases. It doesn't mean that you are working even part-time. But
yeah.
there are different kinds of qualifications. So somebody who's thinking about either taking a leave or going off on a new career path, if you want to maintain that bridge back, keep your clinical hand in at least to the point of staying credentialed and on the clinical staff somewhere. Because once you don't do that, then you're going to end up trying to deal with reentry, retraining, whatever. So, absolutely. You know, look at both. Look at the maintenance of certification and the clinical credentials piece.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And especially with locums, opportunities and things like that these days, that there are good ways to stay clinically active and especially for procedural types of specialties, you know, I think that's really important. I don't mean to minimize that whatsoever. Well, good. So,
you were going to say something and I kind of barged in.
Oh, no, that's okay. I think you made an excellent point. You know, it's the beauty of having Dr. Seibert and I on your program together is, you know, there's a clinical perspective that only a physician knows. And then I fill in with all the regulatory gobbledygook that
people want to know about.
That physicians don't really want to waste their time on. But I don't remember exactly what it was. Oh, I think it had to do with insurance, actually, because that is another really common question. It may be less relevant if your audience involves, you know, a lot of physicians who are looking for careers outside of clinical medicine. Yet it's still really important. And maybe to Dr. Seibert's point, like what happens if you decide to go back to clinical medicine? And so really, really important work direction for us is to make sure that payers are all on board. And we're really excited to report that we've had experienced widespread payer acceptance. Beacon Health Options, which is the largest behavioral health company in the United States. They're owned by Elevance Anthem, over 40 million patients nationwide. They added EbiPass officially. Geisinger Health Plan, which is in my neck of the woods, is the Geisinger Health System really tends to be a progressive, forward thinking. They really try to lead, and they were an early adopter, which was fabulous. We have at least half of the Blue Cross Blue Shields nationally, Humana's HAP priorities, many more. You know, we field a lot of calls from insurance corporates these days, and we engage with all of them to make sure that, you know, essentially we want to remove any roadblock that exists. And so then you, the physician, has the freedom to make the career choices that are right for you.
I love that. That sounds like a lot of important work that you have done. That was probably not easy, especially early on, but probably still, I hope, getting easier, and you've had great success there. So that's super.
Well, let's just say I like a challenge.
That's good.
An amazing job.
I would like to address one or two things just explicitly, because I do get questions about this a lot as well. And I think I know the answer, but I would like to include it for completeness. So a lot of folks who come to the United States who trained elsewhere, international medical graduates who have not practiced in the U.S. nor been certified in the U.S., they would not be eligible for any type of certification within NBPass, I assume. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's correct. Unless they went, right, Dr. Seibert, unless they went back and did an ACGME fully accredited residency, et cetera.
Right.
Okay. That's our primary qualification is you have to have a current, you have to have board certification. If your board certification had lapsed, the requirements for CME hours are doubled.
So that's perfect. You read my mind. I was going to ask you about that. What if you have been certified in the United States, but have let that lapse?
You know, again, when back at, during 2015, when the board was, you know, putting their heads together and thinking what made sense and, you know, what was important, you know, if you've been out for a while, having more CMEs makes sense to make sure you're really up to date in your specialty area.
I am going to ask you even one more question then, because now this makes me think of my own licensure. So in the state of North Carolina, we renew our license on an annual basis. And in the area in which I am supposed to enter my CME hours, it is waived if I'm an active participant in an MOC program. So there's this little box for me to check that, yes, I'm actively participating in an MOC program. And then I don't have to, you know, individually report or meet any of those specific CME criteria. I wonder if being certified in with MBPass would qualify for that. You may not know the answer to that because that's perhaps a niche question, but since it's relevant to me, I figure I may just ask you.
Yeah, that's a great question. This is the first time I've heard it, so I appreciate that. I learned something from you today. That's something I'm going to look into. It'll be first on my list.
Cool. And I think it'll probably have to do with the exact wording. And otherwise, if they're saying an ABMS MOC program, that's one thing. If they're just saying maintenance of certification, we absolutely do maintenance of certification.
Yeah, I always like to say sometimes people show us legislative documents and they're often filled with errors, to be quite honest, because there's a real difference of what I call MOC, all capitals with a trademark, which is a trademarked product sold by the American Board of Medical Specialties, and lowercase maintenance of certification, which is simply a phrase that means doctors maintain their learning. So Dr. Seibert said it perfectly. You know, it depends what they say. If it's trademarked MOC versus, you know, a more generalized idea of what it means to maintain your certification. But I will absolutely look into that for you and let you know.
Well, I'm going to look at it myself when I renew next, because to be, you know, as I'm thinking about this now, what you've just said, I have probably butchered my language throughout this entire episode, thinking about capital MOC trademark versus lowercase maintenance of certification and all the names of the organizations and all the things, because this is not my area of expertise. But it occurs to me, I have never really noticed. I mean, I got the gist of what they were asking and I clicked the box, but I have no idea actually what they were really asking me, because I didn't know there was anything else other than maintaining my certification with the American Board of Anesthesiology for me.
And then the other terminology that's really important is we don't do board certification. We don't give tests. We don't do anything like that. We offer a means to verify maintenance of education, maintenance of evidence-based learning, maintenance of, you know, documentation of legitimate work done to continue our medical education. But we are not and never intend to be in the board certification process or in the testing process. Absolutely no intention of ever going down that road.
Got it. But just to be clear, while we're talking about words and phrases and being accurate, if a person has their primary certification and then maintains their certification via MBPAS, it would still be correct to say that you're currently board certified?
Yes, that you have a certificate with, you know, verifying maintenance of certification in your specialty via NBPAS. And if you renew that every 2 years for the incredibly modest cost of $189, you will get a renewal certificate every 2 years.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the podcast to talk about this. I have learned a tremendous amount. I've really appreciated it. It's totally new to me and new, I know, to I would say almost all of my audience, if I had to guess. And for people who are listening who want to learn more, you can just go to the website. It's NBPAS, as in National Board of Physicians and Surgeons.org. And there's a very user-friendly and instructive website. Is there anything else, Dr. Seibert or Karen, that you would like to tell people in terms of how to find out more or what they ought to know before we end today?
I think I just, you know, I think you covered so many bases, and really we appreciate you taking an interest in MBPass. You know, I think the most important takeaway is something we kind of touched on earlier, which is that, you know, physicians, if this is an important issue to any individual physician, you know, it's important to get on board, to lead. And we have physicians who certify with us, even if their organization is not fully on board yet, even if they're still thinking about it, whether they're in clinical medicine or not, it's an important point of advocacy also to make a statement about, you know, what your values are as a physician leading in medicine. So I really encourage anyone to reach out, look at our website. You can send us an email. The link is there on the website, and we'd be really happy to have you.
Great. Thank you both so much.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Before you go, please review, share, and subscribe to this podcast. Your support makes all the difference, and it truly helps this information reach someone just like you who may really need it. Until next time, thanks for listening.